Welcome to Time to Talk Science and Medicine. This podcast is brought to you by the Translational Institute of Medicine at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. I'm Dr. Charlie Highmarch. I'm an assistant professor and researcher at Queen's University.
And I'm Stephen Archer. I'm a cardiologist and I'm the director of the Translational Institute of Medicine, which we affectionately refer to as TIME.
In this series, we sit down with some of the most accomplished translational researchers and clinicians from Queen's and around the world to explore ideas that are shaping the future of medicine. Every guest brings with them a dangerous idea, and that's an idea that if it was proven true, would change how we understand the disease that they study, or shift the direction of research, or transform patient care. But science isn't just about data and discoveries. We also want to meet the person behind the science and find out what drives them, what inspires them, what keeps them curious. To date, we've showcased work from more than 20 scientists from a wide spectrum of disciplines. We've explored neutrinos with a Nobel laureate, discussed geriatric care and the frailty gap, learned about improving access to care for underserviced populations in Canada, but also in the sub-Saharan Africa, and understood the impact of bringing cardiology to the community.
And today you're in for a real treat because we have my friend and colleague, Dr. Geneviève Digby, in the studio. And Dr. Digby is a respirologist, so a lung specialist here at KHSC, Kingston Health Sciences Center, and she's an associate professor at university. And she's in a very interesting area between research and clinical care of health quality improvement, and she's actually the pioneer of health quality improvement at our university hospital. She's been seeking for many years to improve timelines to care and improve access to care for patients, but her topic today may surprise you as it has a tie to global warming. So, Dr. Digby, thank you for coming into the studio today. I'm looking forward to hearing all about your exciting health quality improvement initiatives and global warming. But before that, I'd love to hear about your origin story. How did you get to be the awesome Dr. Digby that we all have come to love and respect?
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity and for the invitation. I'm excited to be able to share some of my work with all of you. In terms of my origin story, so I grew up in Mississauga, just out of Toronto. I'm an only child. My mother is a nurse and took a great pride in the quality of her work. And I grew up in a household where I was always taught to be the best version of myself that I could be. Always look for, you know, ways to better oneself. And I think I kind of embodied that through my life. My dad was a banker, and so I learned a little bit about more of the corporate world from him. And growing up, I always thought I would be a lawyer because I really enjoyed arguing my points. I liked writing. I liked, you know, really thinking about processes and thinking through arguments. So I planned to be a lawyer. I went to U of T for a program called Ethics, Society, and Law, and with a grand plan to go into law. And I quickly realized that I much preferred my medical ethics course than anything else that I was taking. And eventually realized I was on the wrong path and went into medicine. So here we are now.
It would be absolutely terrifying to face you in a courtroom as a lawyer. For those of you that haven't met Dr. Digby, she's the Department of Medicine's Energizer Bunny. She has more energy and vigor than about any other three faculty members combined. And if that were turned towards law, I can only imagine what we would have got. But we're very happy that your mother influenced you a course in medicine.
And that's not the first time I've heard that thing called the Energizer Bunny. I had that nickname in high school. So
that's tells a compliment. You a little that's bit a compliment. About,
haven't changed much over the years.
So after you went into medicine, obviously you got your medical degree and you know begin to practice your trade. But what made you move into research and what made you specifically improve quality improvement?
So I always enjoyed working in an academic center. I enjoyed the education of it, but I also liked the idea of creating new knowledge. Again, I always enjoyed writing and saw a way of continuing that journey through academic writing. And then the research I was drawn to when I started in medical school and then into residency was really about gaps in care, looking at where there were opportunities to improve the quality of care. At the time, there wasn't really such a thing of quality improvement. Science was just starting off. There weren't many faculty members who did that type of work. And it was really a brand new field. And so I was exploring areas of opportunity for improvement. But it was late in my residency when I realized that the Queen's Health Quality Programs had just started, which was specifically a graduate degree program in healthcare quality improvement. And I stumbled upon it. A friend sent me the link about these programs, said, this sounds exactly like you, and realized it was a perfect fit for where I wanted to go with my career, and I was able to turn it into an academic career.
Yeah, so before quality improvement became an established mm-hmm. research protocol, mm-hmm. Policies and procedures were put into place, and they were never tested subsequent to that. So quality improvement is kind of putting evidence behind why change is necessary.
Yeah, I think people did kind of quality improvement without having a true science behind it at the time. I think people were exploring ways to do that in a lot of different way and using, you know, clinical trials to improve care and doing some education and some standardization type work. But it was really a movement to create a scientific approach, a rigorous way of doing quality improvement that brings in together concepts from engineering, from business management, change management practices, philosophy and psychology. It kind of like brings together different sciences into a more rigorous framework of how to do it in a academic way. And I think that's kind of the field that I've really tried to insert myself into, to be able to leverage some of those tools to do the work in the most productive way to best improve care.
So I'm very proud of Dr. Digby. I think I might have hired her, but she's definitely the first faculty member in the Department of Medicine in the health quality track, which really is, it's a promotion track that we created around her. And we could talk about the science of health quality, and I'm sure we will. But before that, just to give people that are listening an example of how incredibly impactful health quality improvement can be, can you tell them the story briefly of what you did and your team did with the LDAP program for lung cancer patients?
Sure. So when I came on faculty and I started working in something called the Lung Diagnostic Assessment Program, which is a rapid assessment clinic to improve to standardize and streamline the diagnostic pathway for patients undergoing evaluation for suspected lung cancer, we had the lowest survival for lung cancer in our region across the province. And so we used that information to try and identify what are the barriers to care, what are the opportunities to improve care. We launched a series of improvement initiatives over a period of about 5 years that significantly improved timeliness of care and ultimately improved survival. Specifically, we launched a multidisciplinary lung cancer clinic, bringing together collaborating specialties into one clinic space to see patients concurrently rather than sequentially. We standardized the diagnostic pathway to make sure that patients got the right tests at the right time. And we were able to shave off hundreds of visits to the cancer center by bringing people together collaboratively. We saved patients time and money. We improved timeliness of diagnosis, timeliness of oncology assessment, timeliness of first cancer treatment. And we've ultimately demonstrated that LDAP management is associated with improved lung cancer survival. There's a lot more we did in that, but that's a quick snapshot of the type of work we do.
It really was transformative for patients and for the physicians. That created a better working environment. But I think what's interesting for people struggling to say, well, isn't that just practicing good medicine? I think what you did that I observed was you evaluated each of these interventions. So it wasn't just your opinion that it should be done this way, but something was tested. Its impact of that intervention was assessed. And then based on that, it was either kept or modified in some way. So that it is right on that interface between science and medicine.
Yeah, in QI, we call that PDSA cycles, plan, do, study, act cycles of continuous changes, then remeasuring to see what your impact is.
Plan, do, study, act.
Yeah, and then using a series of measures to look at your process, but also look at what your ultimate goal is and what the negative repercussions may be, called balancing measures. So it is a rigorous method by which to go about each sequential change.
So now our audience have an idea of what this work is. Can you just kind of maybe explain what the benefits of this work might be, what the outcomes are?
So the thing with quality improvement is that you can use it to really improve any process that you want to. You can improve your workflow in your day-to-day life.
But this podcast.
You can improve this podcast.
That would be a long project.
But I believe that you can use quality improvement science really to save the healthcare system, to save patient lives. I think if we really were rigorous in how we approach, you know, all the changes we need to make within healthcare, and if we had the right skill sets and the knowledge and the data to be able to do QI properly, we could save the healthcare system. We can make more efficient, more patient-centered, more timely. These are all the domains of healthcare quality that QI espouses.
Okay, so this is perfect timing for the next question of the podcast, which is we like to ask researchers to come onto our show what their dangerous idea, and again, just to reiterate what I said in the introduction, this is an idea that would change or transform the place where you're working. Dr. Digby, what is your dangerous idea?
Everybody who works in healthcare should have an understanding of quality improvement science, because, again, I think it's the way that we change the healthcare system for the better, and that we can get the value for our money, the triple aim that we call it, you know, better patient care, reduced costs, better outcomes. So I'd say everybody should know how to do QI.
And is it something that everyone has the capacity to be a player in, or not necessarily lead themselves? But it strikes me as being the sort of initiative that everyone needs to get on board with. Mm.
So one thing we're actually working on at the hospital in the quality program is a dosing model for education in QI, recognizing that maybe not everybody needs to be an academic graduate in QI methodology, but there's different levels of quality improvement knowledge and skill that I think are applicable to different positions within the hospital. So there should be a foundational basic knowledge of what QI is, how we measure, how we do change management. And then for those who are in perhaps leadership roles, management roles, a bit more of an understanding of how to get change done. And then there's the academics who should take the more scientific type approach, publishing, sharing data, new ways of measurement. But I think ultimately everyone can fit into QI. And that's the nice thing about QI, is that really everyone can do it if you have some basic foundational understanding of it.
And it is interesting, because now the college that regulates physicians in Ontario actually has mandated that we shall all do this. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there are initiatives now at the hospital that we're all, some very heavily involved with, like you, and others more peripheral like me. But can you just mention that, like, doctors mm-hmm. have to do quality improvement at some level now?
That's right. So the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario have mandated that all physicians will participate in a quality improvement project every 5 years. And so to maintain certification and credentialing with the college, you have to demonstrate proof of that involvement. What we are doing with the hospital is organizing our physicians and our divisions and departments in such a way that we can work collaboratively on quality improvement projects and collectively get the credit for the work done, which is far more efficient and likely more successful than, you know, having 500 individual physicians doing individual efforts at improvement. We'll get more quality work, bigger outcomes, bigger successes, bigger programs being tackled when we work on things together.
Yeah, it sounds very exciting, and your leadership's appreciated. So we'll go on to the next. I find with quality improvement projects, it's always nice when you talk about the tangible project. And I'm aware of one of your recent projects, which is I'm aware of it because it was very surprising when I first heard about it. And this somehow connects some simple aspect of respirology to global warming. And my first thought is, it can't be true that something as simple as the delivery of medicines to people with COPD and asthma can possibly be tied to climate change. So bring it on, Dr. Digby. How can this possibly be true? And how is this a quality improvement program?
It's a great question. So what we've realized in the last many years is that the healthcare system accounts for more than 5% of net global climate emissions.
Wow. And
that, the system that's really designed for population health and improving, care for people is contributing to climate change in a way that is potentially harming people. And it's the patients we look after that are most vulnerable and most need us to make changes in that regard. If you really hone in on where some of those emissions come from, a large proportion of them in data from the NHS have been shown to be in pharmaceuticals. And there's a special section in there for metered dose inhalers. And they're getting a bit of a bad reputation.
Just tell us what those are, because as a lowly cardiologist, what's a meter? What's a metered dose inhaler?
Yes, very good question. So metered dose inhalers are what the traditional, quote, puffers that people think about, where they deliver medication through a propellant that expels the medication and you have to inhale it to get it into your lungs. They're very useful medications, and many patients don't have alternative inhalers they can use, either because of young age or coordination issues or lung function. So we do need metered dose inhalers, but the thing that people don't know about them is that they contain hydrofluorocarbons as the propellant. You may think that those were banned many years ago, and in fact they were in a lot of industries, but there was a medical exemption provided for devices such as inhalers such that these propellants still exist and still are in the inhalers that we prescribe and use on a daily basis. In Canada, we use a lot of metered dose inhalers, and they are very bad for the environment.
So this is things like Ventolin, or as patients often call it, my blue puffer.
That would be the most common one used, but there's a lot of controller medications that inhale corticosteroids and long-acting bronchodilators that come in this format as well.
So paradoxically, you're telling me that something that used to be in refrigerators and was chewing up the ozone hole, we got rid of it in refrigerators and air conditioners, but we didn't get rid of it in medical devices. Is that
pretty much correct? Yeah. Yes. There's very different types of hydrofluorocarbons, and different inhalers currently still use different ones, some worse for the environment than others. But yes, they still exist, and they exist in the medications that we use to treat our patients' respiratory disease.
That's so deviously ironic. Yeah. That the person with lung disease that can't breathe is using a puffer to help them breathe, that
worsening
makes the climate worse to breathe.
Yes, and then having a negative cycle on their
And are there currently available alternatives, or is this a kind of a problem that you're just trying to kind of mitigate for, or can you actually replace?
So there are many other inhalers that exist. There are dry powder inhalers and soft mist inhalers. And some of the work I've done with the Canadian Thoracic Society is around kind of how to prescribe mindfully, such that if you have a patient who can use one of these lower carbon footprint inhalers, considering using those where possible. But they're not appropriate for children, the elderly, patients in emergency room settings, in dyspnea crises. So there's certainly a role still for meter dose inhalers. I think we can consider inhalers as a whole in terms of their impact on the environment as well, and not just the propellant alone, but every inhaler that's prescribed is plastic metal packaging. And every inhaler, once done, ends up in landfill. And in fact, we have evidence that 70% of inhalers in Canada are disposed of in landfill. And all of that is bad, regardless of the type of inhaler, on the environment. So that kind of led us to think about what are some other ways that we can look at improving.
And one of the facts, just in preparation for our chat, that you told me about was just the percentage of inhalers in the hospital that have never actually even been used. So they've been dropped off at the patient's bedside, but they're still completely full.
There's a huge problem with utilization. That's one example that we've learned through the project that I'll tell you about. But another thing we've learned through some of the survey work we've done is that probably about a third of pulmonary function labs will use one of those puffer type blue inhalers for the 2 to 4 doses needed for a test and then throw it out in the garbage. There's 200 doses in each of these inhalers. Wow. And so that's a lot of waste and a lot of propellant that's ending up in our environment that's not going to help the patient.
I mean, it strikes me that an awful lot of your work is a structured way of really identifying the kind of almost a 360-degree view, environmental scan, to actually find out what the problems are in the first place. And then once you can identify them, then you can find solutions.
You've just summarized quality improvement.
Excellent.
Well done.
Well, there you go. If I am.
Be very careful, Dr. Highmarch, because that's the way she gets you. The next thing, you're going to be doing work for her. So tell us about this project then. So you recognize that there might be a problem with these inhalers and their effect on global warming. So how did you approach this?
Mm-hmm. So I think, as you highlighted, there are several root causes to this problem and several areas you can tackle in terms of how to reduce the impact of inhalers on climate change. But one area that we demonstrated and found a major gap in was the disposal of inhalers. So, 70% of these ending up in the garbage or in landfill means that that's a lot of plastic, a lot of metal, a lot of packaging, and a lot of propellant that's contributing to climate change. There are ways to better recycle and better manage the disposal of these inhalers. And there's a company specifically called Go Zero. They're a Canadian company out of Quebec. And they have developed a technique whereby the inhalers can be recycled and they will incinerate the propellant so that it neutralizes it and reduces its negative impact on the environment, and recycle the components of the inhalers, so the plastics, the metals, the packaging, in the most environmentally friendly way, thereby reducing the overall impact of inhalers on the environment. So you can procure these boxes that they deliver to recycle the inhalers and respiratory devices, and then return it for them to handle that material most appropriately.
That's really, really interesting. And it made me think, Has anybody ever done this before elsewhere? Like, how much of this is sometimes reinventing the wheel inside your own hospital, and how much is shared through academic best practice?
Good question. So this inhaler recycling initiative is fairly new. The company's fairly new, but it has been, there go zero boxes in many hospitals. I think across Canada, it's probably close to 100, but most of the places are doing one or two boxes. And what we did here at Kingston Health Sciences Center was really a rigorous implementation and spread of an inhaler recycling initiative across the organization at two hospital sites, covering both inpatient and ambulatory units. And then we used Plan, Do, Study, Act methodology, and we used quality improvement processes to fine-tune how we get the message out to people and how we collect inhalers so that we could maximize the benefit across the organization.
What I love about your story, and again, I'm cheating because I know a little bit about your story, but you started off with one box.
Mm-hmm. One box.
During the pandemic, and set it out for people to, if you got an inhaler, throw it here.
It was shortly after the pandemic. But yeah, it started with one box when we were just kind of getting into this area of recognizing, you know, as a respirologist, increasingly I feel that, you know, we need to take some ownership for the medications that we prescribe. That was not something that was ever taught to us when we went through practice. But now that you've seen it, you can't unsee it. You know it's happening. Every time you prescribe an inhaler, those are probably going in the garbage. So we started with a box in our respirology clinic to encourage recycling. And it kind of grew from there. And once we got the Go Zero boxes, we spread. We quickly went from having one box in respirology clinic and one box in our asthma injection clinic to now having 20 boxes across both sites, over 16 units at the hospital, adults, pediatrics, inpatients, outpatients.
That's hugely impactful work. And I imagine it's going to start making it's starting to make a difference into the environmental burden that these units take.
We have just finished our 1 year data collection, and we have recycled over 3,000 inhalers at KHSE for an equivalent of 143 kilograms of recycled material that's been taken out of landfill.
And last year, or before this trial commenced, that was all just getting thrown out.
Yeah, this didn't exist. Some may have been going back to some pharmacies, but it's really unquantifiable on how those were being handled when they got back to pharmacies. We don't know, and we don't think that they were maybe recycled optimally.
Okay.
So it's concerning. Just sorry to interrupt, Charlie. I'm just thinking, you know, the little innocuous looking puffer has that big a footprint. I'm thinking of our cath labs and all the other mm-hmm. things we do in medicine, ORs, operating rooms. Like, we generate so much disposable
stuff. Don't go into the laboratory. Our single use burden in the laboratory is outstanding.
And in fact, I'd like to quantify that further for you, but 1 meter dose inhaler is estimated to be equivalent of up to 170 kilometers of driving in your gas-powered vehicle. So just one of those inhalers. Now, again, there's different propellants and different inhalers, so it can be 40 kilometers for some of them, 170 kilometers for others. But regardless of how you look at it, they have a very significant environmental impact. So if you can incinerate the propellant for those inhalers, you're mitigating a lot of greenhouse gas emissions.
And you were telling me that in Europe, they're working on new propellants mm-hmm. that don't generate the same climate effect.
That's right. So there's one pharmaceutical company that has developed and patented a new propellant that has zero global warming potential. That's approved right now in devices in Europe, and it's being kind of tested to make sure that there's comparable efficacy for the North American market. The hope is that all meter dose inhalers will eventually have a low global warming potential propellant, but it still won't address the fact that there's plastics and metals that come with these that can still be taken out of landfill and better recycled.
Okay, so I'm going to make sure that everyone comes along the journey with us and to make sure everyone's kind of on the same page. And I'm going to ask you to explain this program again, but actually to an audience of high school students.
Great. So we launched an inhaler recycling project to reduce the impact that inhalers have on climate change by appropriately recycling the plastics, metals, and incinerating the propellant of the inhalers. And doing so, we were able to spread the initiative across inpatient and outpatient units and collected over 3,000 inhalers and 143 kilograms of safe material. Now, I don't necessarily have to explain it to high school students, because we actually have a high school student that's kind of joined the team. And we have a grade 9 student. His name is Carson, and he has one of these Go Zero boxes that he's put in place at his high school. And as part of Science Fair project, they've started recycling inhalers at the school. And I think they had close to 30 inhalers within the first 2 weeks. So I think what we're seeing and you know, what we're hoping for is that in true quality improvement spirit, that projects and initiatives that are successful can be spread to the community, spread, you know, even outside of healthcare in a way that still benefits population health. And in fact, this is the type of work that you want to see in the community. If you think about it, it shouldn't be the hospital that's picking up inhalers for patients who, you know, from home, but it's a way of getting things going so that the community can take this on themselves.
And if you make good policies, people do want to recycle. I think the concern is always, what are the central mechanisms? So when you put that plastic and metal in recycling, that actually does not just wind up in Indonesia floating in the ocean, kind of thing, that there is an effective thing. But I guess your point is that high school students are no less able than anyone else to understand and implement this. It comes to them pretty naturally.
Yeah, and I think we all have a role to play, and we all have a potential contribution in this regard. I think, you know, from my quality improvement lens, I think if we can get some momentum behind a project and really kind of empower people to take it on themselves, that's the way to do it. We have in the critical care unit, there's an inhaler recycling box where the staff members are bringing in their inhalers from home and contributing to the recycling project. So this is really kind of spans beyond the walls even of the hospital and just the broader community.
So you've had lots of success. You've been promoted for your health quality work. You're the lead for health quality at KHSC. But I'm sure, like every scientist and physician, there must have been some ups and downs and some bumps in the road. So we like to ask our guests, tell us about a bump in the road and how did you get over it, assuming you did?
Right. So quality improvement generally works best when there's a steady state, when there's capacity for change. And we've been in a few situations over the last few years where that was not the case. So the COVID pandemic was a big bump in the road for QI. You can't do proper QI when you're in crisis mode all the time. You can only really, you can do quality improvement on the things related to the crisis, but all the other things kind of get the sidelined a little bit. So that was one thing that was a bit of a bump in terms of advancing some of the initiatives that we had in mind. But the other one was the change to a new electronic medical record. So again, it's really hard to change processes and get people bought into change management when you don't even know what the new system is going to look like. You can't change things before you're going to get a whole new system anyways. And that was another bump in the road. In fact, it was kind of for those reasons that I turned to an area, not planning on it, but climate sustainability was something that we could still work on, still improve, still do something about, and that there was still interest, even though we were day to day going through big system changes where you couldn't streamline your day-to-day work the way you might want to. But this inhaler recycling initiative was not at all impacted by what was going on with the electronic medical record or any pandemic-related issues. And it was an opportunity to still do change management and QI in a way that was going to improve the health of people in a way that was less impeded by day-to-day operations.
So I'm going to put out the time crystal ball. And I'm asking her to peer into it and tell us what direction.
It's lovely. If you
so
could see it.
Beautiful.
Yeah. What direction is your field going in? What's the next stage for your projects or generally for the field? Where do you think it's going to go?
There's so much to be done. There's so much to improve. You kind of have to go where the momentum is. I'll say, you know, in the short term, there's a lot of momentum for the climate sustainability work that's happening. There's significant interest across the hospital now in expanding to better recycling of personal protective equipment, which includes gloves, masks, visors, and there's big movements with Choosing Wisely Canada to reduce unnecessary usage of gloves that end up in landfill. So, you know, there is a climate crisis. you know, this lends itself well to broad quality improvement work that can change the system. I think it's also going to save us money as a secondary co-benefit. And it's going to kind of just make care better because you're going to choose more wisely in terms of how you do things. So I think I'm going to go with that momentum for a little bit longer, as long as there's the interest.
There's still lots to do.
Infinite work.
100%. So before we wrap this podcast up, we always ask our guest a few sillier questions just actually to find out a little bit more about you. You look very worried, but you don't need to be because they're questions.
Maybe a little worried.
Maybe a little worried. So I'm going to kick one off and ask, what is your favorite meal and can you cook it yourself?
Oh, goodness. My favorite meal. I've always really liked peas, sweet peas. It's not a meal, but it's just anything with that rice and peas, I'll be a very happy person. I can cook that myself, but it's not usually a meal itself.
So risotto with sweet peas.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
fair enough. Put some orzo in there.
Nice.
Yeah, anything with that, we'll be happy.
Excellent.
So Dr. Digby is a major physical fitness expert and aficionado, and I know does hot yoga and things like that. And I assume that during things like hot yoga, one listens to music. Is that does that happen?
Yes, often.
So what is your favorite type of music and can you play it?
It's called Happy Hardstyle is my favorite type of music.
Never
<It's>,
heard that. Happy Hardstyle?
Yeah. So
is that a real thing?
It is a real thing, yeah. And it's exactly what you think it is if you say the words. High energy music. A little bit of synth in there often, a little bit of electronic.
It came out of the house rave scene
at some point. But it's great for working out too, is what I'd say, and very, very high energy, which matches my
like the 135 BPM is that,
yes,
that kind of.
You got to hit that heart rate.
you got to hit that beat
to get that heart rate up. No, I cannot play it myself, but I do have a lot of songs on my Spotify account.
Okay.
They're close enough. So you can press
play. I can press play, which is really what you have to do as a fitness instructor.
So you can play it yourself.
I can play, I guess so.
What is the strangest job that you've ever had?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I did some bench research early on Dr. Archer would love it. But I was looking at integrins. I was using cells that I would run across a slide, and I'd have to measure their speed and how many of them would stop.
Finally,
on the
something
slides.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But you should have led with mitochondria.
Well, yeah, it wasn't strange that just the whole world of working in a biomedical lab when you're a brand new student, it's your first foray into science. Everything's a bit weird about that environment, right? And just figuring out the lay of the land and not doing anything dangerous, I think is.
Labs smell funny.
They do.
Okay, here's a question for you. So if you could travel through time, would you go back or forward?
Ooh, forwards. I'm a forward-thinking person.
Any particular point in history?
Not too far, because I have doubts about our climate sustainability. I don't like it too hot. So
a little bit into the future.
So maybe a little bit in the future, when technology has improved a little bit further, but not so far that there's no more opportunity to go skiing.
Sounds good.
So far enough ahead to see the kind of the outcomes of the research.
Yes,
perhaps,
yes.
Okay, lastly, most important question. If you were a cartoon character, which one would you be and why?
So that's a very hard question, but I'm going to go with Edna Mode from the Invincibles. Design orientated. Stylish, likes
fierce.
A challenge, fierce, likes a challenge, talks quickly, but willing,
and
willing to take anything on.
No capes.
No capes. No capes.
Dr. Digby, on behalf of Dr. Archer and myself, I'd like to thank you for taking time to talk to our audience today about your research. To our listeners, we'd also like to thank you for taking time to get to know Dr. Digby with us, and we hope that you enjoyed the show. If you did enjoy this episode and would like to know more about the research being performed here at Queen's University, or even to share this podcast with other people, you can search for Time to Talk Science and Medicine wherever you normally look for podcasts. Dr. Digby, thank you.